You are listening to the Holistic Travel Nurse Podcast. Boy, do I got a good one for you. Oh my gosh. One of the best ones I've done yet, I found. And I thank God I got like 150,000 views before I'm sure it was polled, because you just can't have this on YouTube. But it's some doctors interviewing about ivermectin. And it's just such a good conversation. So I took most all of it and have it here for you to listen to. And if you don't have your hands on ivermectin, I really think you could get your hands on some oregano, some On Guard, some vitamin D, vitamin C. I can help you with the oils. You can hit me up. I can help you get an account, get them really discounted. I'm here to help you. So reach out today. Get your special deal today and listen to this.
Hey, it's Danielle here at Four Patriots with some really great news. Our all-time best-selling three-month survival food kit is finally back in stock, and I'm thrilled to tell you it's better than ever. Folks, this is big. We've been...
Dr. Corey, just to give you a little my background where I'm coming from, I'm a physicist and computer scientist by training. I'm not a medical expert. I'm a consumer of medicine. And I must, for the sake of disclosure, I have been vaccinated, fully vaccinated. My family has been vaccinated. And I support vaccination because I don't think there's only one silver bullet that everybody should rely on. There are many, many things that people are doing. And if nothing has to be perfect, but if there are ways that we can help reduce this pandemic, why not? So I believe in science. I believe in evidence. If there are other treatments that the modern medicine doesn't support, those should be also brought onto the table. Whether it's Ayurveda, whether it's naturopathy, they should also be considered. All kinds of claims that people have for various kinds of treatments should be given a seat at the table and should be evaluated in clinical trials. So I'm just coming at it as a totally open and neutral person. So with that, I want to ask you a few questions to get the conversation started. There is a drug, so for the sake of our audience who may not know, I want you to explain to them this drug, ivermectin, which is 40 years old and now being used for COVID-19 treatment also. What is this drug? Who invented it? How safe is it? And in what way is it of use potentially for COVID-19?
Yeah, so it's a drug that the discoverers won the Nobel Prize because it was discovered to be an anti-parasite drug, and it transformed the health status of a good portion of the globe starting in the late 80s into the 90s through these public health programs where they distributed it to many, many communities in which parasitic diseases like river blindness, onchocerciasis, strongyliasis was endemic. And in fact, there were communities in Africa where most of the men in the community were blind by the age of 40 due to this parasite. And so it really transformed the health status. And it's such a major impact that it was awarded the Nobel Prize by the discoverers. One discoverer was Satoshi Imura in Japan, a microbiologist. And what happened with ivermectin is about 10 years ago, they started testing it in other disease models, in particular viruses. So there's about 10 years of bench study of ivermectin's activity interfering with the ability of a number of viruses to replicate. And so it's shown to be effective in Zika, dengue, West Nile, influenza, even HIV. And then about a year ago, when COVID broke out, there was also a bench study showed that it was effective in SARS-CoV-2. So it's not only an anti-parasite, it's now essentially proven to be an antiviral. And the reason why it's proven an antiviral is because in the clinical studies, we're seeing what's called a dose-response relationship, meaning in every trial in which it was tested and the investigators measured the time to viral clearance, you saw faster times to viral clearance if you're on ivermectin, and the higher the dose, the faster it cleared. And so it's essentially proven now to be an antiviral agent.
So there's a cause-effect relationship, because you increase the dose, you increase its effectiveness. And so you can say that more is better. There must be a cause-effect. It's not going
to. Exactly. It's one of the pillars to prove the efficacy and action of a drug. If you see a dose-response relationship, it's like another source of proof.
Yeah. So now, because it's 40 years old, I presume it's off of patents, and lots of people must be manufacturing it. And so that may have something to do with the politics of the economics of it, because the big pharma are not in control of it. They don't make a whole lot of money because lots of people in various countries are making it. I'm told it's also made widely in India and used quite widely. So tell us about how widely it is manufactured all over the world and used, and the Western countries' pharma industries don't really control the money made out of this drug.
Yeah, so it's off patent. You cannot make great profits off of it, but you can make some. You can make modest profits. I don't know why we always have to talk about billion-dollar blockbuster drugs, but certainly it's cheap, it's safe. There's many manufacturers all over the world, a number of manufacturers even in one country. And so it's what I call a non-profit drug. And so because of that, you're right, you do not see, no one is going to invest money in getting ivermectin through the regulatory processes. And so there's no one to champion this drug. There's no one to hire teams of $800 an hour lawyers to sit at the FDA and the NIH. And I mean, that's the challenge with our system, right? So I want to say a brief thing. So it's not just ivermectin. So ivermectin is what we call a repurposed drug. And this story that I'm just telling about ivermectin is not new. I mean, repurposed drugs, this is what happens to repurposed drugs. If you have a chief off-patent drug that's shown to be effective in some disease in which there are competing, very expensive, pharmacy-supported drugs, you generally will see it dismissed, distorted, suppressed, and ignored. And so ivermectin is just the latest example. It just happens to be a particularly egregious one because it's so potent and effective in this disease, and we're in a pandemic that's out of control. And so to see this story playing out again, this is really beyond, far beyond anything that's ever been acceptable.
So, but the people who are criticizing the use of ivermectin say that there hasn't been a large double-blind study. So it's anecdotal, examples here and there, people have used it successfully. What do you say to that? Why, what do you say to this fact that there really isn't a double-blind study of a large consequence, and what should be done about that?
Yeah, so that is their classic, that is how they are trying to suppress this drug. So when you look at what's called the pyramid of evidence in medicine, We have this concept, we call it the pyramid of evidence, which is the strongest level of medical evidence. And at the bottom, it's like a study in a test tube, like in vitro. Then you might have a case series, so a little bit of case experience, then a small observational trial, then maybe a randomized controlled trial. And then at the top is actually a collection of randomized controlled trial in which you can do what's called a meta-analysis. So a meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials, whether they be small or big, is actually the highest level of evidence. It's not a single trial, it's not a single large trial. That's a construct that actually has been promoted by the pharmaceutical industry and the regulatory agencies. So the regulatory agencies, they're used to getting these large trials, sometimes not so large. And that's why I also have to call out that this system, which somehow prefers or seems to exclude anything but pharma-funded large trials. Some of the trials aren't large, and some of them are not really well done, and there's some statistical hijinks that happen in some of them. So they're very irregular in what they do. But yes, they've been dismissing ivermectin because it doesn't have that single large trial, but ivermectin has 31 randomized controlled trials with over 3,000 patients in them. That is a very large body of evidence. You don't need more than that. and they're literally setting the bar for ivermectin very, very high, and they set the bar for the other drugs that they like very, very low. Like remdesivir, it was 1,000 patients. It's been used all over the world, using all over the country at $3,000 a dose, and it doesn't even save a life. So you have to understand there's these really anomalous behaviors. It's inconsistent, and we have our health agencies literally putting themselves in between the doctor and the patient, telling the doctors what to use, and very little of it makes sense.
So it seems like it's clear the pharma industry have a financial vested interest in new drugs that they have come out with, which are under patent, while they want to disincentivize and abuse and suppress very old drugs that may be repurposed successfully, but they don't want it because they're off of patents. Lots of people in the world are making them. Nobody will make any money. It's very cheap. Poor people can afford it. So it's a kind of a rich man's industry, a trillion dollar pharma industry, and therefore that is there is a politics behind this whole thing. That's your thesis. Now, but the government regulators are supposed to be above all that. The FDA and the CDC and the academic peer review papers, and the people who publish these, who are the publication houses. Why do you think they are also a kind of not doing their job as honest, fair, neutral, participants? What is the relationship between the pharma industry and these forums and these platforms and regulators that you can throw some light on?
So what you just said, that they're supposed to be above all that, these agencies, they're supposed to be committed to the advancement of public health. I have to tell you, that is the hardest lesson I've learned in my life. I didn't believe I would see the behavior that I'm seeing amongst agencies across the world, most of the Western world, even not Western world, almost every country at the federal level, there is lots of fights around ivermectin. And I think there are well-meaning agencies, and I think there are people that are trying to champion it. But the influence of the pharmaceutical industry at the governmental and agency level is profound. And the way I understand it, there's a revolving door, they're all friends. I think also I've seen incredible amounts of laziness in that when someone says, for instance, what you said, which was, the people are saying that, oh, there's not one large trial, they're all poor, low quality, small trials, they haven't proven it works. Most people believe that. And they'll just believe it and parrot it. So a lot of it is just laziness. They believe the pharmaceutical companies, and nobody's interested in going against this massive influence and trying to champion ivermectin. And so it's been very disappointing.
So, yeah, having been in the corporate world,
yeah, it's called captured. I believe that the regulatory agencies are captured. I think this is evidence of regulatory capture.
I'm not surprised. I mean, it's disappointing, but I'm not surprised, because in various industries where I've been, I've seen similar things happen in the decades. I used to be in telecom, and the Federal Communication Commission, FCC, was a regulatory agency, and everybody, ITT, AT&T, all kinds of people were influencing them here and there. A lot of legal maneuvers and all that. So I think the industry, regulators, media, publishing houses, academics, there's all kind of incestuous relationship there. And those with a lot of money tend to be people in the industry, and they want to influence this. So I can buy that. What is you started an organization called FLCCC. Tell us what that does. What does it mean? What does it stand for?
So the FLCCC is the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance. Okay. And we were, what happened was, when COVID started coming to the US, when we started to see that this was gonna get real, I mean, I think if you remember the beginning, we thought it was just gonna be something in Wuhan, but then in Lombardy, Italy, they started to get, completely collapsed, their critical care systems collapsed, and then Seattle. And at that time, we knew that this was coming, and it was going to be likely a worldwide pandemic. And so some doctors went to Paul Marek, who really is our founder, a very famous doctor, has made many contributions to medicine. And they said, you got to put together a protocol, because Paul Marek is famous for his protocols for other critical illnesses. And so they said, get a group together and, you know, start putting out there some guidance on how to treat the disease. And so I'm lucky to be a very close friend and colleague of Paul. So he asked me and a few other doctors, including Umberto Maduri, who's one of the world experts in corticosteroids and lung disease. Joseph Ferrone has been editor of many journals and highly published guy. And so we have a very highly credentialed, well-known group of doctors. And we started to put together our initial protocol, which was for the hospital. And it's actually fared quite well. We did really well. Just so you know, our protocol from the beginning had corticosteroids in it. And that was at a time when the entire world, every national healthcare agency said, do not use corticosteroids. And so we were attacked and criticized for that. In fact, I testified in the Senate back in May of 2020, and I told the world in Senate testimony that they had to use steroids. It was critical that they use steroids. And like I said, we were really criticized for that until 6 or 7 weeks later, when Oxford did some big randomized controlled trial, and it showed that it indeed was life-saving, and steroids became the standard of care overnight. So I bring that up to say that we've always been ahead of the evidence, and I think our protocols have been sound, physiologic, effective, and life-saving.
So certainly, you know, for my viewers, as a non-medical person, what I support as a scientist is that evidence of various kinds and claims of solutions and treatments of various kinds have to be given an audience, have to be given a fair shot. And then based on the evidence and the debate, people can decide for themselves. Nothing should be blocked off, nothing should be censored. And that is the problem that ivermectin seems to be facing, and people who are promoting it seem to be getting, hounded. Now, I want to discuss why is it that recently New York Times published a list of a dozen or so what they claim to be the most serious offenders of misinformation on COVID. And they listed, three or four of the people they listed were actually champions of ivermectin. So why has the media and in some ways the government, sort of targeted people promoting ivermectin as people who are spreading misinformation, almost like if they're criminals? Is the money issue chasing the chasing COVID-19 solutions so huge? I mean, I know it's huge, but is that a reason why even the government and all the media are chasing ivermectin, because it's a threat to the
Yeah, so, okay, I'll give you my take is that, and I haven't seen the list, but I'm going to guess that the people on the list, although they're advocates for ivermectin on the early treatment side, they're also folks who've questioned vaccines, the safety and efficacy. And so I think that's how they got on that list. I think no one's on there really for ivermectin alone. If that were true, I would be on there. I don't think I'm on there. At least I didn't hear I was on there. I think that's more about trying to fight any information that goes against vaccines. To advocate for ivermectin, I mean, it's an FDA-approved drug. It can be used off-label. A large portion of prescriptions written in the U.S. are off-label, and it's one of the safest drugs. So it's hardly harmful, to advocate for its use. And the amount of data to support is overwhelming. So that list is one example. However, we are labeled as medical misinformationists, and we are censored. So on lots of social media, in fact, most of our videos, instructional videos, lectures on YouTube, interviews on YouTube get taken down as soon as we talk about ivermectin. And so there's a lot of censorship on the topic. Anything that does not comport with a recommendation from the WHO or the NIH is considered misinformation. And it basically, it's outlawing scientific debate in a public forum. I think it's a tragic mistake.
Yeah, I mean, as a scientist in other fields, of course, the same principle. I mean, science depends on people making breakthroughs, people questioning what the previous scientists felt. What was Newtonian laws were questioned by Einstein in relativity theory. I mean, there's hundreds of examples where science concludes something, and then later on it challenges it, concludes something different. So if you don't allow that process, if you don't allow debate and controversy and people challenging, and some government people or some, you know, some people with a vested interest clamp down, and social media says these guys will be outlawed, you are against free speech and you're against research and R&D. I mean, and research is fundamental to, you know, human progress. So I'm very disappointed and surprised. This was brought to my attention by a number of people, and I decided I should interview and find out all this. So now you raise an interesting point. Ivermectin debate has become coupled with vaccine. If it were decoupled, maybe ivermectin would be not considered as big a threat, because some people are doing vaccines, they let them go and do their vaccine, and those who want to market and, you know, do research on ivermectin would continue doing that and let both of them play out. Certainly there's a need for as many solutions as we can. I'm not against vaccines at all. I'm quite ambivalent. I have taken it. I think some of the results show that the incidence of disease comes down, probability-wise. So I want to find out from you, is the case for ivermectin contingent on and related to a case against vaccine? Is it like a zero-sum game? If one is good, then the other should be bad? Or what's your take on that?
No. So my take is that we need as many tools to fight this pandemic as possible. So I see them as complementary. We use the phrase that we think that ivermectin is a bridge to vaccination and a safety net for. So if the efficacy fails, ivermectin would be there as a safety net. And for those who can't get it, who are contraindicated from receiving it, refuse it, or even the vaccinated who are worried about the falling efficacy against some of these new variants, it would be available to them too. And so we think it is another tool in the toolbox. The vaccination policymakers, and I think the vaccine manufacturers, they don't look at it as a complementary, I think they look at it as an opponent, and that it would fuel that vaccine hesitancy and it would prevent them from vaccinating everyone. And I think that's why ivermectin is treated as a foe, and all of these actions are taken against it. All the denigration, all of the distortions of the science around it, and it's tragic.
So looking at it from the pharma industry's point of view, what I'm hearing is that they would say that while by itself ivermectin would not be a threat to them, but the point is that once you popularize it, and it's inexpensive, it's an easy solution, it's been there for 40 years, there is no side effects. So therefore what will happen is people will not get vaccinated. And so in order for them to get vaccinated, you've got to take all the alternatives off the table. And one of them, and the main one, is ivermectin.
Well, there's another argument too. So one is, on a practical level, yes, I think they're worried that if, like as you said, if ivermectin's efficacy were widely known as a preventative, because you can take it every week and it largely prevents people from getting sick. I mean, some of the trials are showing like almost 100% efficacy in prevention of illness. And in many of the trials, it's around high 80s to 90s. And it's proven to be effective even against all the variants. So that would be one reason why I think the vaccine industry looks upon it as a competitor. The other is the way the EUA is written, which is the emergency use authorization for the vaccines, that was granted to the vaccines under the condition that there was no effective treatment for the disease. So if a treatment is identified and shown to be effective, and ivermectin is very effective early on in disease as well as later, in fact it works in all phases, but it's really most potent as an early disease intervention, a lot of people think that would actually threaten the EUA for the vaccines. So there's even more concrete reasons why I think that ivermectin is being suppressed.
So we can in summary, we can say that the people who are advocating ivermectin do not consider vaccines as a threat, but as something complementary that could be researched in parallel. But the other way around, people, the industry that is championing vaccines, don't consider ivermectin as a friendly complementary thing. They see it as a threat. So the fight is coming from their side, and they are the guys with the big guns and lots of money and clout in Washington and WHO and so on. And so they have succeeded in trying to outlaw ivermectin.
Well, there's also more opponents than that, right? So, I mean, I could come up with a list. So the first would be the vaccine policy and lobby. The second would be there's a number of oral antiviral pills that are in the pipeline at Merck and Pfizer. Those are natural competitors to ivermectin. If ivermectin is recognized and approved in society to use as an oral antiviral pill, those very expensive pipeline drugs that they're trying to make would disappear. The other is all of these expensive monoclonal antibodies that they're trying to infuse to people in the outpatient centers, that would decimate that market. Remdesivir market would be decimated because we know from public health ministry initiatives, particularly the one in Mexico, that up to like 76 to 80% of hospitalizations are prevented if you use ivermectin early on. And so there's more competitors against ivermectin than just the vaccines. It's almost incalculable the size of the market that sees ivermectin as an opponent.
So broadly speaking, can we say the pharma industry creating vaccines and treatments, various solutions, that is highly Western countries controlled? I mean, they tend to be, you know, American, you know, European kind of pharma countries, companies, because the budgets needed are huge, and the science is very sophisticated. Whereas the people who want to champion ivermectin are in poor countries because it's so poor. It costs very little. It is very effective. It's easy to manufacture. So in a sense, WHO is sort of in the middle. WHO has a lot of there's a lot of clout from the Western countries, from China, Western countries, because they have the money and they fund it. But WHO, the way it goes, in the direction it takes, it's able to influence governments in hundreds of poor countries. And so if one were to ask, why would a poor country somewhere start towing the line and banning ivermectin, would you say that it's the role of WHO, or would you say that the government itself has made a mistake?
Hey, so check it out. This is a emergency sleeping bag. These things normally cost $30, and during the wintertime, people pay full price for them all day long. But because it is the summer, or it's about to be the summer, Patriot Wholesale Club has way too many of these sitting inside of their warehouse, and they need to get rid of them to make room for new inventory. So they're gonna put them on ultra clearance and give them away for free. All you have to do is pay for shipping on this guy. Now, why would you want this? So here's an emergency sleeping bag, completely laid out, 7 feet long, 3 feet wide. Inside is a special reflective material that makes sure that 90% of your body heat stays trapped inside of here. So if you're ever caught in an exposure to the element situation, it's gonna keep you nice and warm. Plus, it's waterproof, windproof, and then it is stretchy too. So that means that you can go ahead and slide in here and...
I don't think this is a problem just in Western countries. So I think there's money at the tops of government everywhere, and there's vaccine money and pharma money, even in non-Western countries. That's number one. And by the way, I do want to say one thing, that the way I speak about this system and what I'm learning, I was taught this a little bit before, you know, and I kind of suspected, yes, there's influence, yes, there's corruption, yes, you know, it's not all above board, you know, the way the system works. But what I've learned, having this front seat, becoming an ivermectin expert and seeing the behaviors and what is happening, and then really the lies, the half-truths, the mistruths, it's been a shocking lesson into this system at work, and it's been really demoralizing because of this pandemic and the amount of people that are dying. But so I don't think it's just Western. I think at every government they fight over ivermectin, and the WHO, I'm sorry, but I've come to learn that that's probably the most captured agency. They are completely under the influence of their funders, and their funders tend to be rich countries and vaccine money.
So where does China come into this debate?
Well, China does not seem to have a problem right now, do they?
I Wait, are they selling ivermectin?
I'm gonna pass on that. They're not. So they are. They're one of the producers of what's called the API, which is the active pharmaceutical ingredient. I think there's about three or four of those in the world. And so yes, they do produce a lot of API, and that goes around the world. So yes, they do. They do manufacture a lot of that.
But do they administer ivermectin to their own people? Is it allowed there as a treatment?
I have not heard of it being used, but I also don't. They don't have a problem with COVID right now, from what I understand.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a big mystery, you know, is there a problem or not in China, and what is the magic if there is no problem? I mean, some people say that their vaccines haven't been very successful when they exported them elsewhere. So how would they, without a good vaccine, how would they avoid COVID?
This is my guess, I'm not an expert on China. But my sense is that extremely sophisticated test, treat, source control, quarantine efforts. I mean, if you saw what happened in Wuhan after that outbreak, they literally tested, I don't know, I thought it was 10, 12, 20 million people in the span of 2 weeks. They basically pinpointed every single case. They quarantined, so they have excellent sort of public health infrastructure that you don't see that kind of resources elsewhere. That's my guess.
So given that this zero sum game, this competition has been started by the vaccine lobby, that for vaccines to succeed and new pharma treatments and patents to make money, ivermectin is the sort of drug that has to be boycotted and so on. And now you see that the social media is also aligned with that. They will, the moment you say the word COVID or ivermectin in any of these YouTube videos or Facebook, they'll signal, they'll block you, they'll ban you. We get all kinds of threats, and many of my videos have been taken down, although this is the first time I'm interviewing anybody on ivermectin. But I did interview people on Ayurveda. I interviewed people on various other forms of treatment.
Yeah.
And we were blocked, and we were told that, you know, sometimes that, okay, the video will remain, but it will not get promoted. You will not get even one-tenth as many views unless you change and edit and, you know, all of that. So I understand that this game is going on. I'm very disappointed that it's not just the pharma industry, but a whole lot of other industries that have joined in. Why would these trillion-dollar companies, these social media tech companies, they have more money than the pharma industry, why would they not be supporting the truth and saying, okay, we allow all sides to come and debate, because that's what debate is for, that's what speech is. You know, why are we going to say that anything said by this particular camp is called misinformation, as if they're a bunch of criminals? I mean, let them have their say, and then let intelligent people decide, let there be evidence, and let's debate this. Why do you think the tech people, coming from supposedly a very liberal background and always championing free speech and so on, and research, etc., why would they play this kind of dirty game?
You know, I think there may be a benign and a sinister reason. The benign reason is that they're actually providing a public service that's of good meaning. But that falls down very quickly, because I really disagree with the idea that discussing drugs, interventions, medicines that are not approved by the leaders yet, and discussing its relevant efficacy or touting something that works, they elevate that to the level of like hate speech or incitement of violence. Like, it's not that dangerous. You know, right. Most people, like you just said, I totally like what you said, is that let people decide on their own. It's essentially saying that all of the citizens are too stupid to use judgment. We don't trust their judgment, and therefore we're going to protect them from people who say this works or that works. And it basically takes away the sense of agency of a citizen. And I mean, censorship has never been shown to be good. And so they're literally censoring medical debate. So that falls on its face, but they might think that they're doing something good. Now, the sinister is that, and and this is, it's in an emergency power, and I think they're all, it could just be a coordinated ability, again, to get in between the doctor and patient, which is, they want to determine what the patients get. The agencies decide what the drugs are. All discussion of everything else is removed. And everything now is very centralized. Like, everybody's following, like, the one protocol from the NIH. And it's absurd. Remdesivir doesn't work. It's shown in multiple studies not to work. And yet it's the mainstay of our treatments.
But, yeah, and so, Dr. Corey, could there be yet another factor which I want to bring in? And that is politics. So when this whole COVID started, this whole controversy started, I think there was very early on a polarization between Republicans and Democrats, between conservatives, liberals. And so when some people of a certain political party or for political persuasion decided that they don't want to be vaccinated, there's all this anti-vaccination conspiracy that, you know, Bill Gates is injecting a chip in your body and all that stuff. A whole lot of stuff happened, and this, and the allegations that Dr. Fauci was involved in Wuhan lab research, etc. So this business of one political camp attacking the other political camp with some kind of a conspiracy theory, and then the other political camp counterattacking them as sort of, you know, you guys are unscientific, you are boycotting, you know, science, and when you avoid the vaccine, you're being anti-scientific. And now the debate has overflowed into, look what's happened to the states that did not promote enough vaccines. You know, their cases have gone up, and because of this Delta variant, etc. So do you feel that the polarization which happened particularly in the United States, and then it went overseas also, this might have been a factor in why, you know, the liberal left kind of, whether it's CNN, media people, or whether it's Facebook, because they're all liberal left, whether it's Google, do you think that the reason the social media started supporting the vaccine camp against the ivermectin and any other camp has to do with the Democrat versus Republican polarization, and they happened to be in one camp, and so they had to support that camp carte blanche? Do you feel that the politicization actually made matters worse?
You can get this pack of emergency food bars.
Oh, it's complicated. I mean, what I think is the Democrats or the left have traditionally been more trusting of government, right? And they are interested in good government. And I think they trust in the government's judgment here. And so, whereas the right tends to put itself in opposition to attack big government and mistrust government. So I think that's where the alignments, and when you're talking about the public health agencies, right, that's government. And so, although yes, there's a political sort of overlay there, it's my understanding of a lot of the vaccine hesitancy is that some of it is a lot of a pre-existing sort of notions. It's not a fact of misinformation, which is telling them not to get vaccinated. These are people who naturally have had that mistrust and distrust of government even before the pandemic. And so I'm not totally convinced that it's, I don't think it's a, you know, I think the left is convinced that it's all this misinformation that they're believing, and that's why they're not getting vaccinated. I think that's true for some. But, you know, I read an article recently where I think they made a very persuasive argument that these are like pre-existing sort of principled attitudes, and they weren't going to change, misinformation or not. And so I think it's complex. I can't hold myself out as an expert, but I have seen the two polls, and I have seen politics get mixed into it. And it's a shame because, you know, science is not about politics. Science is science.
So if we turn our attention to India, because I'm told you're also very knowledgeable and familiar in India, in some states it's not available, in some ivermectin, in some states you can go and buy it, some doctors can prescribe it. It used to be part of the treatment plan of the Indian Ministry, Health Ministry, and then WHO came and changed it. In some states they listened to WHO. And so now WHO is now at the center of controversy in India, because they have interfered and changed what the Indian authorities and government and states were doing. So what do you think of that? Because, you know, India likes to be very autonomous and claim and say that we are free, we don't worry about international pressure. But here is this big brother WHO with a big stake, able to switch Indian policies. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, I think that the states in India that broke free from the WHO saved hundreds of thousands of lives. That's number one. Number two, I think the leader in India in use of ivermectin in their public health response to the pandemic is Uttar Pradesh. And I think they have outperformed almost anywhere in the world. Their number of cases and deaths per million people is tiny compared to the U.S. and to many other places. You know, during the April-May sort of surge in India, yes, Uttar Pradesh had a large spike, but it went down very quickly, and they're back down now to like very few deaths a day, sometimes none, in a state of 234 million people. So that shows you that the most forward-thinking and the one that broke free from the WHO, they did phenomenally well. And I think they should be an example to the rest of India. But what you just said, like, what I'm finding is that even in countries where it's used or it's somehow got on the national guideline and it's considered to be used, there's still lots of disagreement. Half the doctors don't believe it works. The other half say it works. I'm helping my patients. And like, there's just so much, there's a lot of polarization around it. It's not only political. It's, I also think some are under the influence, of financial interest. But there's also this scientific skepticism that's imbued in many physicians. And they, once they've decided that something doesn't work and they've made that statement, they've taken that position, it's very hard to move them from that. And so I see just so much controversy around a simple, safe, and highly effective drug, and it's really disheartening. But there's a few forces that do it. Whereas in Uttar Pradesh, the doctors that started that program and have championed that program, they're analyzing their data now, and I think their report, hopefully the world will pay attention.
So in the case of Uttar Pradesh, because it is such a huge population, it's a poor state, I mean, they don't have the money to go, buy very expensive stuff. And so if they've taken this stand that they'll go for ivermectin and it has worked for them, the data shows it, this is huge evidence, more important than any clinical trial. So this should be showcased. Is there correlation? Now, this is an important question. Is there correlation between the use of ivermectin in Uttar Pradesh and the saving of life? Or are there other factors? I mean, maybe something else that
Google mobility, so you can look at cell phones and see what the overall mobility amongst the population is. We have not seen the correlation with lockdowns. We have not seen changes in mass wearing. We've seen the tightest correlations with the use and distribution of ivermectin. Uttar Pradesh has not yet put out their report analyzing the impacts of how they identify people, who they treated, what the outcomes were. But guess what? Mexico has. So the other leader in the program using ivermectin is actually Mexico, and one of their state health their data yet, but Mexico has. And I thought that the Mexico paper, it's in a preprint form, it hasn't been peer reviewed yet, but I thought that should be on the front page of every newspaper in the world, which is to say that a large city, one of the largest cities in the world, managed to essentially beat back a pandemic and open up society. And yet nobody talks about it.
You know, you would think that a respectable show like 60 Minutes would talk about this issue. I mean, they would go and bring in, they would go to Pfizer on the one hand, and they would go to Uttar Pradesh and Mexico on the other hand, and they would interview, look at data, get a team of experts to make sure everything do, for the sake of either political benefit or financial advantage or whatever. This will have to come out one day, because how can it remain hidden? If it is the elephant in the room, this is something so large, it just cannot be suppressed forever. So what would you say to that?
Well, yes. So you've interviewed Brett Weinstein, correct?
Yes.
Yes. And so when I was on Brett's show, he called the show, we did similar, we went into this topic of our Brett, he called it the crime of the century. And I do believe that there's going to be a reckoning. And I do believe that there's going to be really, really hard lessons learned here of some true criminal activity that caused countless lives. And my hopes are that we're going to finally learn that the behavior of this for-profit system. You know, we live in a healthcare which has a for-profit system, and the power of these pharmaceutical companies are so large, and unfortunately they do not put the health of the patient as a priority. And you're seeing it to take it to such absurd levels in this pandemic that I think that as a society, we can't look away anymore. We can't say, oh, it might be happening. We're gonna show in excruciating detail exactly what these behaviors led to and what they caused, which is untold misery and death.
So this has been very exciting.